Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Okay, the doctrine of predestination is one of the more vexing and terrifying mysteries of the faith. There are plenty of vexing mysteries. This is certainly one of the more terrifying ones. And no amount of study and insight will resolve the tension in our minds. So that's it will help clarify, definitely, and to rule out error, clarify the faith, lead to contemplation even. But problems are to be solved. Mysteries are to be contemplated. So we're not going to solve. Well, if there are problems, we can solve problems in our articulation and wrong thinking. But there's a mystery here which is not going to be solved. So the situation is that God alone can make the beatific vision possible for us. You're not going to get there on your own, even with really good weight training and eating right. That's not going to happen. And he owes it to no one. But God, we will never be truly satisfied if we do not have the beatific vision. So that's a tension right there. God has to give it to us, but we won't be satisfied without it. And we can add to this that God is so merciful that he took human flesh to himself and suffered and died for us sinners. So there will be tension in our minds as long as we are on earth. So we can think of the parable of the fig tree, where the orchard owner wanted to cut it down, and because the fig tree had been unproductive for 3 years, we're told. But the gardener suggests giving it one more year, during which he would work with the tree. So he says, and if the tree is still barren after that, then he says, go ahead and cut it down. The drama of the fig tree manifests God's terrifying mercy and his terrifying justice. So in the parable, the orchard owner stands for God. The tree stands for each one of us. And the gardener seems to stand for Christ, right? The Son, God the Son. Now, the figure of the gardener raises a question. Can the Son, in his divinity, recommend a different plan to the Father than the Father intended? So that's a little funny. No, that would make for a poor parable because the Father and the Son have one same intellect and will. Even if we consider the Son in his human nature, the metaphor limps. Because Christ's human intellect and will are in perfect conformity with his divine intellect and will. But it's worth the limp, because it illustrates that Christ intercedes for us at the right hand of the Father. This manifests God's, you could say, terrifying mercy. We don't know how to ask for mercy, for as Paul tells us in Romans, for we do not know how to pray as we ought, but the Spirit himself intercedes for us with sighs too deep for words. So God has taken human flesh to himself to ask for us. He's asking himself with a human voice. This is mercy of a depth that we cannot imagine. And this could make us think that it would be possible for us to be lost. If Christ takes on human flesh and dies for us, there's no way we could be lost. And although it would be too strange, this metaphor would be clearer if the gardener were actually another tree, right? Because the Christ took on human nature. It would be a perfect tree bearing perfect fruit, and it would ask the orchard owner for more time for this loser barren tree, and it would, assist the barren tree, not only by example, but say, by grace, right? By working inside of it. But paired with this mercy is justice. The gardener only gets an extension of one more year. If the tree doesn't produce, then it will be cut down. This justice of permanent alienation from the garden is terrifying. So it's easy to think, I'm a nice guy most of the time. God would never let me go. But he let Lucifer go. Okay, so it would be, he'd let the whole human race go. If he let Lucifer go, we should not think too highly of ourselves, too over-exaggerate our importance. We know from the saints that he saves many, but his justice is terrifying. Yeah, so, can you imagine he let the highest creature he created hate him and be lost in hell forever? So when you think about the terror of being lost, you could even wish that you weren't free, right? You could think instead, you know, Lord, just simply bring me to heaven without involving my freedom. Just don't ask me, just save me. You know, because are we reliable enough to have salvation come about through our own consent? Pretty scary, right? Through God's initiative and our constant assistance, of course, but through our consent. Every one of us is free. Any one of us could turn away. But that's how precious a gift it is for us to be made in God's image. We're free in God's image, as God is free. So it's an unspeakably eminent privilege to participate in our own salvation. And if we are to have a reward as great as the beatific vision, it's fitting that we merit it to the degree that that's possible. So God works through us, gives us this grace, this gift through our own free will. So how should we think about predestination then? It could be said that the Catholic Church rejects Calvin's idea of double predestination, namely that some are made for heaven and some are made for hell, in favor of a doctrine of single predestination, namely that one can only be predestined to heaven. That is, as taught in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, God, I give you that quotation, God establishes his eternal plan of predestination, but predestines no one to go to hell. In other words, those who are not predestined to heaven are not predestined to hell, but they fall away from their true end of beatitude, despite being called by God to that end. So there's not a symmetry. You're predestined to heaven, or you fall away. In fact, if one were made for hell, he should be quite happy when he gets there, right? Sin is missing the mark. If one who's made for hell hits the bullseye when he arrives there, if that's where you're made, you're like, I made it to hell. You know, that would be, hell is only hell for one who's made for glory, but tragically misses the mark. While Aquinas never speaks of a single predestination, he expresses the idea in his contrast of the causality in predestination versus reprobation, and which we'll talk about later. And in his assertion that it is God's antecedent will that all be saved, yet God's consequent will that ultimately unrepentant sinners be condemned, which also we'll discuss later. The doctrine of predestination points to God's initiative, to the primacy of grace. The term predestination is found in Romans 8, 29 and 30. Those whom he foreknew, he predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son. But the word can be misleading, for it can make us think of before and after in God and also the annihilation of free will. And the implication of this would be that the reprobated were predestined to hell, right, without choosing it. But this sense and its implication are false. To have a sound understanding of the doctrine of predestination, we have to get away from this mistaken view. The doctrine of predestination only attempts to clarify the deep and bewildering mystery that, first, no creature can attain the beatific vision without being chosen and assisted by God. And second, any creature that falls away from this end does so through the devastatingly poor exercise of his free will, which we call sin against Almighty God. Right? That's it. That's those two are enough to. Those are the two principles at work here. Since we exist in time, we naturally speak of God's destining ahead of time in predestination. But it might help to recall that in his eternity, all things are present to God simultaneously. So, for example, Mary said, "Be it done unto me as you have said," and she made it to glory. You say, wow, all on her own? No, God helped her with grace. He destined her. And you're like, wow, did God know this from all eternity? Yes. Oh, so he predestined her. Yes. Well, then she wasn't free. Oh, yes, she was free. God's foreknowledge, God's providence, does not impose necessity on all things. The more humanly intuitive but theologically problematic alternative to predestination is to hold that God waits and sees how things will turn out, such as our penal system does. But the doctrine of predestination is an inescapable conclusion if God is omniscient and creatures need assistance in coming to final beatitude. Right? He sees all things, everything is simultaneously present to him, and we can't get there without his help. Neither God's foreknowledge nor his assistance by grace disables our free will. Nothing is more natural than when God moves our wills. Indeed, they cannot operate according to their free natures without him. So he first gives and preserves their free nature in creation, and then heals and assists them in grace. Freedom does not mean acting apart from God, right, getting out of God's control, but rather means being the principal and master of one's own actions. It might be easier for us to conceive of this by taking a God's eye view, by considering how things will look at the end of time. Then we will see who has come to glory and who hasn't. Right? So that is, who was predestined and who was reprobated. We will be able to understand that this came about through the person's free will, assisted by grace or resisting grace. The results, though, could have been otherwise. These labels didn't impose necessity on angels and human beings' outcomes. Of course, God sees all this from all eternity, so we can say that God predestines and reprobates from all eternity, but without diminishing the free will of angels or humans involved. So two key points here are God's offer of grace to all people and man's ability to reject grace. So along with the Catholic Church's condemnations of Jansenism, which Father Tim will talk about later, Vatican II's Gaudium et Spes, number 22, which I give you on the outline there, suggests that grace is offered to all humans. So if I just read, you got four or so lines there. All this holds true not only for Christians, but for all men of goodwill, in whose hearts grace works in an unseen way. For since Christ died for all men, and since the ultimate vocation of man is in fact one and divine, we ought to believe that the Holy Spirit, in a manner known only to God, offers to every man the possibility of being associated with the Paschal mystery. And although he's not talking about grace, we could appeal to St. Paul's letter to the Romans for the idea that all men have a chance to find mercy on the day of judgment. That's 2:14-16. When Gentiles who do not have the law do by nature what the law requires, they are a law to themselves, even though they do not have the law. They show that what the law requires is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness to their conflicting thoughts. While their conscience also bears witness and their conflicting thoughts accuse or perhaps excuse them on that day when, according to my gospel, God judges the secrets of men by Christ Jesus. Concerning man's ability to resist grace, so there we see grace is offered to all, but we can resist it. Aquinas speaks at greater length and more explicitly in the Summa Contra Gentiles than the Summa Theologiae. But also I'll just read you that passage there. He says, we should consider that although no one can merit or summon divine grace by the movement of his free will, he can nevertheless impede himself from receiving it. And since it is in the power of the free will to impede or not impede the reception of divine grace, guilt is not unjustly imputed to him who places an impediment to the reception of grace, because God, for his own part, is prepared to give grace to all. For he wills all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of truth, as 1 Timothy 2:4 says. But those alone are deprived of grace who place an impediment to grace in themselves, as guilt is imputed to him who shuts his eyes when the sun is shining. If something bad follows from this, although he would not be able to see except by the light of the sun. Right, the sun's shining, you close your eyes. That's on you. This assertion helps us to understand how man can be blamed for his sin. This does not dissolve the mystery of why God declines to prevent this failure, but it does account for the real choice and real guilt on the part of man. So without the assistance of God's grace, we cannot be saved. God offers salvation to all, but we can reject God's grace, and God may leave us in that state of sin. So, God predestines humans to glory. This is what Aquinas asserts in the Summa Theologiae, question 23, article 1. He notes that rational creatures have a twofold end. So one that's proportionate to their created natures, human or angelic, and can be attained by their natural powers, and the other that exceeds all proportion and faculty of created natures, namely the vision of the divine essence, seeing God without mediation. Since no creature can attain this higher end by its own powers, it has to be directed to this end, as an arrow is directed by an archer. There is simply no way for man to find his way to the beatific vision through his own power. He must be brought there by God. This is a key principle that makes predestination inevitable. God has to destine us for eternal beatitude. Otherwise, you're not getting there. Now, the plan for this direction pre-exists in God, as we said. Aquinas explained in question 22 that providence is the plan of order for things to an end. So that's how does God provide? He has a plan of order, of bringing things to an end. How does God provide? Yes, through a plan. More specifically, the plan then for the direction of a rational creature toward the end of the beatific vision is called predestination. So predestination is a part of providence. Providence is not providing for all things by having the plan for bringing them to the end. Predestination is for rational creatures coming to the end of the beatific vision. Aquinas makes a provocative remark in his reply to the fourth objection in this article. He says that even if by a special privilege some had their predestination revealed to them, it's not fitting that everyone should have it revealed to him. Because if it were, those who were not predestined would despair, and those who were predestined would become negligent. So you can see what he's getting at, but on the other hand, if you become negligent, then you weren't really predestined, it would seem. And if you're predestined, it hardly seems to matter that you would despair. If the predestined could become negligent, then why couldn't the reprobate be scared straight? You know, it was right. But we can talk about that more later. Now, I made a few claims that could use some more explanation, so we can consider those now. First, I said that God's foreknowledge and providence do not impose necessity on all things. How is that possible? If God knows everything in advance, and he has a plan of order to bring things to an end, then isn't it all locked up? I mean, he knows it, and he has a plan. No. In the Summa Theologiae, first part, question 19, article 8, Aquinas succinctly offers his brilliantly insightful account of how we can still act freely, and there can still be chance or coincidence in the world, even though God's will, which is necessary and unchanging, is always fulfilled. So I'll quote him there. God wills certain things to come about necessarily and other things to come about contingently. That is, again quoting him, since the divine will is most efficacious, not only does it follow that the things God wills to come about, but they come about in the way in which God wills. End quote. So, in other words, God's will is so powerful that he can determine that some things happen contingently. Right? They happen, but they could have not happened. That's kind of amazing. So God is in himself necessary, but he can produce a universe, and it's on account. It's not that things have to get away from God's will to be free. No, actually, it's God's will is so efficacious, so powerful and fruitful, he can will things to be contingent, to happen when they didn't have to happen. Yeah, God determines not only what will happen, but also whether it must happen and whether it could have been otherwise. An important example of this, of course, is human free will. God can will that something occur through free will, human free will, which therefore didn't have to happen, right? One can choose whether to put on his left shoe or right shoe first. One can choose whether or not to repent of one's sin and whether or not to pray. You can choose that. But whatever is chosen is already known to God and only happens by his causing it to happen as the first cause of all things. Right? So it's not an either or. These things go together. God knows it already. He makes it possible for you to choose it. But you could have chosen one way or the other. It's not determined Now, God wills some things to be necessary, right? Whether you eat broccoli or spinach, and when you eat it is contingent, but in order to stay alive, you must necessarily eat something, barring a miracle. When and how you die is contingent, but that your body and soul will be separated in death is necessary. At the most profound level, all of creation is contingent, right? It could have been otherwise. We didn't have to exist. But within the created order, God wills some things necessarily and other things contingently. It is not ultimately because the proximate causes are contingent that the effects willed by God happen contingently, but because God wills that they should be contingent. So if there is a series of causes that are acting contingently, yes, the next effect is contingent. But more profoundly, the reason it's contingent is because God wills that he wills it through contingent causes. Yeah, so it's not because of any lack of power or immediacy of God, the first cause, that there are contingent causes, as if, yeah, the secondary causes have to get away from him, which is what happens, you know, so often when we attempt as principal causes to act through some tool, right? Things get away from us and are contingent in that way. You're trying to use a hammer or use a computer and it just, you can't make it do what you want. Exactly. So one could feel the need to affirm God's power by asserting that there's no contingency, right? He's so powerful, so there's no contingency. Because contingency or chance would seem to contradict necessity. But on the contrary, it's a manifestation of God's power that he can will things to happen contingently. He can will them to take place when they didn't have to. He can give a true nature to a true secondary cause, and he can ordain a natural order in a created universe where things happen contingently. God's not nervous about not having enough control. As the interior universal cause of all being, nothing falls outside of his providence. Absolutely nothing. For Thomas, God is utterly dominant, but at the same time, dominantly generous and life-giving, not tyrannical and suffocating. Okay, so that was one of the principles we wanted to think about. I want to mention just the scientia media, middle knowledge, just briefly. Father Tim might take it on more completely. I forgot whether he is or not. But so the scientia media just means middle knowledge was a solution of Luis de Molina, a Spanish Jesuit. He lived from 1535 to 1600. This was his solution to the nature grace problem. The problem is as follows. If I cannot refuse God's grace, then I'm not free. But if I can always refuse God's grace, then when I don't, I should get the credit for every graced action because I could have said no, but I didn't, so I get the credit. But in that case, the semi-Pelagians are right. I meet God halfway, and that's ruled out. So then, you know, who would save me? I would say, well, God and me, right? But this has been condemned, so we face a theological dilemma. So Aquinas will say that God sanctifies us without us, but does not justify us without our consent. However, even our consent is a gift of grace. God's grace is always intrinsically efficacious and is not extrinsically based on our action foreseen in some middle knowledge. That is, God. It would be God intuits. He knows whether or not I would not. Am I going to accept grace or am I not in this circumstance? If I would accept it, he gives it. If I wouldn't, he doesn't give it. That way, there's never you never have to conclude that I can refuse grace because I never get the chance, right? So God avoids the conflict. And my freedom is not compromised because my grace only comes when I would have chosen. But this explanation introduces major problems, more problems than it resolves, actually. Here, God is reacting to the creature's possible action. So that introduces passivity into God. And freely willed human actions fall outside of God's knowledge of future contingent events. That is, in this view, God does not simply know them in the eternal now. They're between God's knowledge of possible being and his knowledge of contingent being. So here, conditioned future events are removed from the determination of the divine will. Why? Because you're afraid that if we say that they're determined by the divine will, it will make them not free. It's exactly not appreciating what we just saw Aquinas describe in question 19. Here there is a conflict, because if you don't have the both end, then you're going to have to choose who's acting. And so if you say, well, God looks ahead, and then he acts on what you would have done. But that's incorrect. God's knowledge of the future does not impose necessity on the outcome. God's providence and determination of things does not impose necessity on the things planned and determined. So in this middle knowledge, the scientia media, human freedom would be outside God's divine motion, which is impossible. This is to misunderstand God's agency. God is the universal cause who moves the free will according to the free nature he gave it. So nothing's more natural than when God moves our wills. We're not fighting with him over who moves our wills, right? He makes it possible for us to have a will and to move it and to be the principle of our own actions. Right, we couldn't move our wills without his moving it also. God is not a competitor for our wills, as if, you know, acting on the same level. He's acting as the universal interior cause. So Molina takes God's and man's causality here in a univocal sense. Aquinas takes them as analogical to each other. That is, God can foreknow and predetermine without taking away freedom and chance. So our free actions are not necessary. Okay, I also claim that nothing is more natural than when God moves our wills. But if God moves it, how can we say that it's we who move it? Well, let's think about natural inclination. So in the De Veritate, question 22, article 1, Aquinas explains that something can be directed to an end in two ways, so either by itself or by another. An example of something directed by itself, is a person walking from one place to another. Self-direction is only possible for beings with some kind of cognition, because even a dog moving from one place to another, moving itself. How about being directed by another? Well, this divides into two. There are two kinds of being directed by another: violent and natural. An example of violent motion is an arrow being shot by an archer. Here, the arrow is directed to an end by an archer, but the archer does not give the arrow any form by which the arrow would have an inclination to the target. Not a form in the arrow itself. I mean, it gives it the trajectory. You give it the trajectory, but the arrow sitting there afterwards, right? It's not like it goes by itself. An example of a natural motion is a stone falling to the ground. So here, God gives the stone an inclination toward the center of the earth, right? Because it gives it gravitational attraction based on mass. So we can see that everything, even inanimate things, can tend naturally toward their ends insofar as they receive an inclination so that they act according to their own natures along with the one directing the thing to an end. So that's it. There's in things that are directed by others, they could be violent, but it can also be natural. So God can give us a will that's inclined to the good. It moves toward the good by its very nature. So when God preserves it in existence and moves it, it's not a violent motion. It's not like shooting an arrow. Rather, the first cause is acting on the level of a first cause, and the will moves itself according to its own nature toward the good. The will never seeks an evil as such, but only accidentally, insofar as the evil accompanies some good. The object of the will is always the good, and never evil per se, but only accidentally. So think of, well, what about cases where someone deliberately wants to do evil, right? Well, there the good being sought is what? Power, autonomy, the exercise of freedom, justice, truth, you know, self-expression, something like that. For instance, one might be thinking, I'll teach God a lesson. I'm going to do this evil thing. I'll show people that I'm powerful. Or I'll show people, you know, these happy people, that the world is really an ugly place. Or I'll not be ignored. I'll show them how much pain I'm in. There's a marvelous case where a bank robber, he's very successful actually, he said he viewed himself as an educator, he said, because he, when he was a child, his mother died and his father turned to drinking and then became physically abusive. And so he he said, you know, he would go into the bank and he'd see these oftentimes middle-aged empty nesters. And he's just this is his sense that they're like, you know, you play by the rules, you win. And he was like, he'd say, no, no, that's not what happens. What happens is your mother dies and then your father becomes abusive. And he said, and so his understanding of educating them, he said, he'd stick a gun in their face and say, give me the money. And he's like, see, you thought the world was a friendly place. I'm showing you how it really is. So here, this is the idea that you're choosing some good, right? You can know that something's evil and choose it because it's evil, but your will is necessarily attracted to the good. Although the good may be only apparent, so not true, and is certainly chosen in a disordered manner. That is, if you choose the evil, it's because you think it's better, if you want to say more good, than choosing the opposite. It furthers your end. Even if you deliberately choose an end precisely because it's recognized by all as objectively evil, it's still the case. You're choosing it, why? Because it's good in some way. The good is simply and inevitably the object of the will, and it moves toward the good by nature. So God can strengthen and inflame it to move towards supernatural goods without any violation of its nature.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.